When Jeanne Romée, whom we know as Joan of Arc, was burnt at the stake in Rouen in 1431, she stood convicted of a number of counts. And one of these, which was accepted by the ecclesiastical court before which she was tried, had to do with the fact, the charge that she had dressed as a man in order to embolden the indolent and cowardly man, Charles VII, who occupied the titular role of King of France. This young girl who had heard voices commanding her to save France and to crown the king had gone to Orléans dressed as a man, and there she had maintained that dress, and when necessary, in order to stimulate and to encourage the knights of France, she had dressed in white armor and gone out and led the troops into battle. Now, had the basis of this charge is a rule that appears in the book of Deuteronomy to the effect that a man shall not dress in the attire of a woman, and a woman shall not dress in the attire of a man, for whoever does these things is abhorrent unto the Lord your God. Now, whatever be our present attitudes towards the difference between a man's world and a woman's world, it's clear that in the biblical world, and all those societies which have been conditioned by these traditions and attitudes, there were two separate areas of life, two separate costumes, two separate communities, two separate worlds, that of the man and that of the woman, and that every effort was expended to see to it that those who lived in one world remained citizens of that world, rather than crossing over. The Talmud puts it this way in explaining this law: a man shall not dress in the attire of a woman and live in the world of women. A woman shall not dress in the attire of man and live in the world of men. Obviously, every attempt was expended to try to avoid sexual perversion, or the pathology which has to do with the confusion of one's sexual identity. And this remains a constant of the biblical interpretations in Christianity and in Judaism down to modern times. Now, I doubt that the inquisitors in Rouen knew the Talmud. Sure they didn't. But had they done so, they would have found there a minority of opinion which would have been very useful to them in their case. For at least one of the sages insisted that the concern of the Bible was not so much to keep men and women from simply dressing up in an occasional party for the way the other sex did, but as he put it, "Shelo tetze isha bichli zayin lamilchama," that a woman should not go out bearing weapons into war. War was a man's business. A woman's business was in the home, with their children, in another world entirely. Now, it makes sense, really, when one looks to the nature of ancient warfare, to assume that war was a man's business. Hacking around with a sword requires brute strength and nothing more. And physiologically, the male body is stronger and heavier, more able to hack away at someone else endlessly than a woman's body may be. But in modern warfare, a war is conducted with highly computerized equipment, jet planes and missiles and nuclear submarines. Warfare is conducted by the mind and by the reflex and not by physical strength. One doesn't have to manhandle a weapon in order to be successful with it. Unless we feel that we are as liberated as we sometimes think we are, I remind you that despite the change in the nature of warfare, when in the last several years the administration has tried to reintroduce registration for the draft, A great furor went up in the land when some who insisted that women were persons and not a separate world demanded that the registration include our women, our girls, as well as our boys. And in point of fact, that's the way in which the law is written. We still operate with this assumption that there are two worlds, that they're very different. And consequently, many who have been raised in this cultural attitude have come to the conclusion, falsely, that there is something innately combative and competitive about the man, and something innately passive, peaceful about the woman. Aristophanes in his Lysistrata takes as his basic theme the idea, as you recall, that the Greeks will avoid the endless struggles within their cities and between their cities only when the women have deposed the men, because as long as men are in control of the Senate, there will be fighting and there will be violence. But women who are taught to make peace between their children, to keep peace within the family, they will be the ones who, by their very nature, will establish peaceful relationships in the community and between communities. And as I recall the peace movements of the last 20 years, there was a great emphasis within them that finally the women were coming into their own because women's liberation and the peace movement coincided, and that as women occupied their proper role in society, society would become more passive, and warfare would begin to just be displaced by peacemaking as the basic responsibility of governments. I hate to say it, but the people who are the theoreticians of women's liberation are right. Women are persons, and they are subject to all of the infirmities of emotion, all of the passions to which men are subject, provided that they are within the same context. Their lives make the same demands of them. The Bible, as you may remember, and as often we forget, is not simply a white-bound book full of moralistic, high-blown, high-sounding, high-meaning phrases. It's also an anthology which contains a great deal of the early history of Israel, the history of the community when it was still in the Bronze Age, when the law of blood retribution was the basic law of justice between the tribes back in the second millennium before the Common Era. And one of the virtues of this fact is that the Bible does not allow us to maintain these romantic notions about the peace-loving nature, the elemental peace-loving nature of women, as opposed to the elementary competitive and combative nature of men. One of the first historic incidents which occurred to the tribes once they had begun the conquest of Palestine, of Canaan, was that the Canaanite cities banded together under a king by the name of Yabin, who was king in Hazor. They began to press the new insurgents rather hardly and rather successfully. And the tribes met in council, and they didn't know quite what to do. And there arose around the year 1210 or 20 before the Common Era, perhaps a little later, we're not sure of the exact date, a lady by the name of Deborah, who was given the temporary brevet because of her courage and her iron will as the shofate, the military judge of Israel. And though she isn't the exact counterpart of Joan of Arc, who was, after all, nothing more than a young adolescent who still loved to get out there and to do physical things with the boys, she was the one who rallied the spirits of Israel. She was the one who organized the strategy of the armies of Israel. She was the one who established Barak as commander-in-chief of the Israeli armies and told him what to do and where to go and how to do it. And it was because of her military skills that she is remembered, because it was by virtue of her will and her skill that Israel survived that early counterattack by the Canaanites. And the interesting thing about this story of women and war is that it ends with an act of revenge by a woman which can hardly be called ladylike in that romantic sense in which some people take it. Sisera was a general who was commander-in-chief of the Canaanite forces. And when Sisera was defeated in battle, he fled. And he fled to the camp of a certain Kenite by the name of Heber, where he had reason to believe he would be received and kept safe. And a woman by the name of Jael, who was the wife of this Heber, went out to meet him, and she said, "Come in peace." And Sisera, who had fought for a day and a long day in a battle, was exhausted, said, "Give me something to drink, and stand at the door, if you will, while I grab 40 winks in order to have enough strength to move on to escape from those who pursue me." And Jael agreed, and she provided him with food and drink, and the exhausted warrior fell asleep on his bed. And then this lady-like woman took one of the tent pins, one of the iron pins which held the tent in the ground, and a mallet. And she took the mallet and took the pin, and she drove it through the temple of the sleeping warrior, killing him, obviously. Hardly what we would call an act by one of a sex who are somehow different than the male sex in their competitiveness and combativeness. One can find reasons why she may have done it. She may have sensed that the Israelites would be the ultimate victors, and fearing that she and her husband would be taken in as accessories to the Canaanites and found guilty and punished by the Israelites for their actions, she may have done this. But nevertheless, it's an act of violence. And when Deborah heard of this act, she sang a great song of victory, to which she added this: "Most blessed of women be Jael, wife of Heber, the Kenite. Most blessed of women in tents. He asked for water, she offered milk. In a princely bowl, she brought him curds. Her left hand reached for the tent pin, her right for the workman's hammer. She struck Sisera, crushed his head, smashed and pierced his temple. At her feet he sank, lay outstretched. At her feet he sank, lay still. Where he sank, there he lay, destroyed. So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, and may his friends be as a sun rising in might." All of this is by way of preamble to the lady that I want to introduce you to this morning. A lady by the name of Judith. If she lived, she lived about 1,000 years after Deborah and Jael. And she lived probably 1,600 years before Joan of Arc. But she is their sister in will, in spirit, in her willingness to use the weapons of war. The story of Judith appears in the Bible of the early diaspora, the Septuagint, the Greek translation. It was not accepted into our scripture, and so it's not part of our Bible. But it remained as one of the books of the Apocrypha, those separate books which were maintained by a number of the Christian communities as scriptural, and so they have survived to our day. The book of Judith was well known in the late pre-Christian centuries, 4th, 3rd, 3rd, 2nd, 1st centuries before the Common Era, and it's worth for a moment for us to remind ourselves or to hear for the first time about this lady whose heroism was worthy of a great novel. Let me tell you about Judith. The story is set in the years immediately after the return of the Judeans from the Babylonian exile, from about the 4th century, maybe the 5th century, before the Common Era. The story begins with the fact that Nebuchadnezzar, who's pictured as king of the Assyrians, is troubled because many of the little kingdoms and principalities in the west of his empire, are beginning to be restless and are refusing to pay tribute. Now, the very fact that Nebuchadnezzar is in this story, who lived at least half a century before the end of the exile, and that Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia is called an Assyrian, who were the kingdom that was destroyed by the Babylonians 125 years before the return from the exile, suggests what is in fact probably true, that this story is an embellishment of an old folk legend. It's an historical novel at most, and perhaps it's entirely fiction. But nevertheless, it was well known and well loved. And nevertheless, according to this story, Nebuchadnezzar appoints a man by the name of Hophernes, his greatest general, to be general of an army of 120,000 picked troops who are to march to the west across what is today Syria and Lebanon down into Israel and re-subdue the city-states and the small kingdoms of that area to make sure that they are subservient to the Assyrians and that they pay their taxes and their tributes on time. Hophernes marches west. He has several quick symbolic victories, and the small countries that are ahead of the advancing troops take notice and immediately send their ambassadors to make submission bearing their tribute. The west is entirely resubdued except for the kingdom of Judea. And in those days, the kingdom of Judea consisted of the small area which is in the hill country of Israel and the hills of Judea. And the high priest in Jerusalem, according to this story, decides to fight against the Assyrians, and he sends a letter to all the frontier towns to this effect. We are a hill people. The way to Jerusalem is controlled by a number of valley passes. If we fortify the mouths of these valleys, it doesn't matter how many tens of thousands of men the Assyrians have. They have to come through one or two abreast, and our troops can easily deal with this narrow file of soldiers. And among the places to which this letter is sent is a town called Betulia, which apparently is at the defile of one of the valleys as it opens up into the Esdraelon. And when the Assyrians camp in front of Betulia, the magistrates of the town do as the high priest in Jerusalem orders them to do. They fortify the mouth of the valley. And being a good general, Hophernes stops long enough to make reconnaissance against his enemy. And he calls and summons to him the leaders of all of the surrounding and neighboring countries and says to them, tell me something of the nature of the Judeans. And one man by the name Achor, an Ammonite, says to him, the Judeans are descendants of Abraham who came out of the Chaldean area. They settled here 1,000 years ago, and then they went down to Egypt where they were enslaved, and they managed to break out of Egypt and to conquer this country. And then God, for their sins, exiled them from the country, and then later they were allowed to return. And now they have established a series of communities centered on Jerusalem, where their temple and capital is. And one thing is unique about this people, and that is that they cannot be conquered unless they have sinned against their God who exiled them 200 years ago for their sins, might cooperate in their defeat, but he protects them unless they sin. And Hophernes, commanding the largest, the most powerful army on the face of the earth, laughs at this last bit of information. And he says to Achor, you are my prisoner. If you are so confident of what you have said to me, I'll test that confidence. I'm going to turn you over to the Judeans in Betulia, that city up there, and you'll live just as long as it takes us to conquer the city. So Achor is taken to the Judean lines, and he's passed through these lines, and he comes into the city. And then, being a good general, Hophernes decides that the way to conquer the Betulia and to open up the valley so that he can move on to Jerusalem is to starve it out. He can't make a frontal attack, but he can send soldiers who will take the springs from which the Betulians draw their water. He can interdict all the roads which bring provisions into Betulia, and it won't be long before the Judeans will have to surrender the city. And this he does. And then the scene in the little novel switches to the Judean town, and we see the magistrates in the town being besieged by the townspeople. The siege is now about 3 weeks old. There's very little water. The provisions have begun to run down. And the people are saying to their magistrates, surrender the city. God has forsaken us. There is no one to save us. Unless we want to see our women and our children starve before our eyes, let us surrender. It's better to be slaves than to die of starvation, as we are certain to do. And the magistrates respond by temporizing. They say, in effect, yes, it seems as if God has abandoned us, but God may yet save us. We swear by an oath that if within 5 days salvation, saving has not come, we will surrender the city to the Assyrians. And now, finally, we meet Judith. Judith is a widow who lives on a country estate just outside of Betulia. She's a very beautiful woman. Somehow all heroines of antiquity are very beautiful. And she's very pious. She's known for her wisdom. She's known for the fact that in a country, in a community which is not noted for its religious scrupulosity, she pays the tithes. She made regular pilgrimages to Jerusalem. She's maintained herself in widowhood in a proper way. And she summons the magistrates of Betulia to her. And she says to them, in effect, you have done that which is wrong. God has his own reasons. God cannot be put to the test by us. If God has decided that we must be defeated, it is for our sins. Or perhaps God is simply scourging us in order to try us and to train us. But God can put us to the test. We cannot put him to the test. We must have faith. And the magistrates protested that the people had, out of their need, complained, and they had importuned them to change the position. And in fact, there would be great carnage unless they did. And in any case, they said, we have sworn an oath, and what has been sworn cannot be gone back on. So Judith decides to take matters into her own hands. And she orders her maid to take out the trunks into which 3 years before she'd put all of her lovely clothing when her husband had died, to take with him the most lavish and beautiful of all of her clothes. She orders her maids to dress her in these garments and to make up her face and to put on the finest perfumes, to prepare some luggage which they will take with them when they leave the city, including all of those beautiful things that she has, and to prepare a large bag into which they will put sufficient kosher food in order to protect her, to provide for themselves upon the journey, because as a good Jewish lady, she wants to be sure that she does not eat anything which she ought not to eat. And she leaves after a great prayer to God to strengthen her will. She leaves the city, and she appears before the Assyrian camp. And when the guards come out to meet her, they are dazzled by her beauty, and she says to them, I wish to see your commander. And knowing that the commander had an eye for a pretty lady, they take her to Holofernes, who is dazzled by this Judean lady's beauty. And she says to Holofernes as follows, I have left Betulia because I disagree with the policies of the magistrates. I know that we ought not to be struggling against the power of the emperor. But Achior, who has come to us, was right. We Judeans cannot be defeated unless we have sinned against God. But do not despair, my general. The Jews will soon sin against their God because provisions are running low. And soon they will violate the law that food and drink which has been dedicated to the sanctuary cannot be tasted by those who are not priests. Out of their desperation, they will break open the consecrated food, the consecrated vessels of wine, and drink from them. And when that happens, you will easily conquer the city. And I will be able to tell you when that happens, because I will go out each night into the valley, and I will pray there to God, and God will reveal to me what he plans to do. Well, Holofernes is delighted to have a beautiful diversion during this campaign. And he invites Judith that night to a fine and lovely feast he has prepared in his tents, and he has all of his generals there and all of their finery. And a lovely time is had by all till 10 o'clock or so, when Judith announced that it's time for her to go out into the valley and to pray to God. She goes out with her maid and she prays. She takes with her this vessel, this bag which contains the properly prepared food that should not be touched by those who are impure, and she returns to her tent. Well, Holofernes, the second night, determines to have his way with Judith. And the second night, he invites her again to a feast. And this time, he sees that his generals are not invited, only his immediate household servants, mostly eunuchs. And in anticipation of the joys which will soon be his, he has a great deal to drink. And after the feast is over, the eunuchs and servants quickly disappear from the tent, leaving only Holofernes and Judith and her maid. But Holofernes is on his way to being drunk, and he lies down on his bed in anticipation of the night that lies ahead. And Judith, taking advantage of the moment, reaches over and takes the general's sword, and with two well-placed cuts, chops off his head. And then she takes the head, and she puts it in this bag which is prepared for the kosher food, which she has to take with her out into the valley. And she calls to the guards, because it's now the regular time for her to go out to pray. It's time for me to go and pray, and I'll soon return. And the two of them go out into the valley. The tent is closed behind them. And now in the valley, instead of stopping and praying, she simply continues on to Betulia, is admitted into the city, and she tells the magistrates of the city what she has done. Now these worthy but confused gentlemen appreciate the valor of Judith, but they wonder what's to be done. There's still 120,000 men camped down in the valley below and probably less than 1,000 warriors in all of Betulia. So Judith has to take matters into her own hand, as Deborah had done once before, and she says simply, take the head of Holofernes and hang it from the gate of the city, and at dawn, marshal our men and place them outside the city as if there's to be an attack on the Assyrian camp. And the Assyrian sentries will notice what we are doing, and they will report it to their lieutenants, lieutenants to their captains, the captains to their generals, the generals to their commander. And when they come and try and awaken Holofernes, there'll be great consternation. And when we make as if to attack at the very moment when their commander is missing, there's likely to be confusion. There is certain to be confusion, and we will win the day. And so it happens. The Assyrians flee. The Betulians and Judeans are victorious. Great plunder is taken, shared by the troops. They give to Judith the plunder from Holofernes' tent, which is wealth indeed. And she, being the pious lady that she is, takes all of that plunder to Jerusalem in a pilgrimage and dedicates it to God in the sanctuary. And then she returns to Betulia, frees the handmaiden who has been with her and throughout her adventure, returns to her estate, where she remains a widow despite many offers of marriage by men who are attracted by her beauty, her wealth, and her fame. And she lives on to be 105, a great matriarch in Israel, full of peace and full of honor. Now, what are we to make of this story, besides the fact that Judith was a person capable of doing what any man might be capable of doing? Remember, I mentioned last week when we talked of Tobit that the basic theme of Second Temple times was the idea that there was a covenant between God and Israel. That if Israel abided by the law, by the Torah, by God's instructions, by what was required of them, God would protect them and reward them. If they sinned, they would be punished, and what was true of the community was true of the individual. And of course, when anyone looked around himself or herself at life, experience did not bear out the fact that life is like a classroom, where if you hand in a neat paper, you're rewarded, and if your paper is delayed and not appropriate, not proper, you receive an F. And so the great issue was, what is the purpose for the confusion, for all those things which happen in life which do not conform to our faith? The book of Job raises these questions. The book of Judith tries to provide the conventional religious answer. And that is that often we are tested. Often the evil things happen to us in order to test our mettle, or as Judas suggests, in order to scourge us, in order to improve us through suffering. There's a concept in the Jewish tradition called Yesurin Shel Ahava, the afflictions with which God afflicts us because of his love for us. That sometimes as we grow up, we grow precisely because tragedy comes upon us. Sometimes it's only when we have been hurt that we become human, that we become sensitive to the needs of others. Now, this is an explanation, a partial explanation to be sure, but one which this book tries to suggest in the speech that Judith gives to the magistrates when they have essentially put God to the test yet 5 days, and God may will or will not save us, and then we will do what we have to do. That Israel must have faith in God regardless. There's a second theme which I think is implicit in the book of Judith, and that is that in many ways it exists as a counterpart to the book of Esther. Judith and Esther are the two great post-exilic heroisms of late biblical times, heroines of late biblical times, but they're very different. The better known, Esther, the better known to us, is a woman of courage. But in terms of the conventional religious values of the day, she is a woman who raises a number of questions. She joins the harem of a non-Jewish king. She's willing to engage in a beauty contest in order to win that dubious honor. Once she has entered the king's palace and his service, she eats whatever is placed before her. There's no concern about the purity, the religious purity of the foods that she eats. For some years in the palace, she dissembles. Ahasuerus is unaware that she is a Judean until she reveals this fact to her. Not once in the story of Esther does Esther pray to God for guidance or for deliverance. What Esther and Mordecai achieve, they achieve on their own, through their own planning, through their own devices. Compare Judith. Judith throughout is a pious woman. Judith entices the non-Jewish general, but she does not have relations with him. Judith takes with her that famous large bag of kosher food, food which is satisfies the rules of ritual purity. The very word Judith, which means Yehudit, the Jewess, suggests that she is in every way the model of what Jewish, the behavior of a Jewish woman should be. Instead of being interested in the jewelry, the finery that obviously intrigues Esther, she delights to dress up as the queen. This woman has put all of her finery away. She takes it out only in order to save the community. So in many ways, Judith is the antithesis of Esther, and a way for Judean, for Jewish parents who tell these stories to their children to give a different kind of model to children who might be enticed otherwise to follow the way of Esther. And it's interesting that in Palestine, where Jewish life was to a large degree lived in and among its own, the book of Judith was not deemed to be necessary. Whereas in the diaspora, where Jews lived as a small minority among larger majorities, the book of Judith was consecrated, made much of because of the nature of the model of the heroine that it presented. But finally, when all is said and done, I think that the answer is simple. Judith is a good story. It's a rousing tale of heroism. And it's a tale which promises a troubled people that if they have faith, and if they will act on faith, they will be saved. Judith is a widow. The widow is a symbol in biblical times, the most unprotected of human beings. Again and again, the Bible says to the says that if you want to show charity, if you want truly to show compassion, then take care of the stranger, the widow, and the orphan. These are the three categories of people who are not truly protected by society or by the law. And so whatever act of generosity you show towards them is an act of supererogation. It's an act beyond that which is demanded. So the heroine of this story is a widow. And it is through the least protected, the least powerful member of a society that salvation comes. If Israel has faith, then truly Israel will be saved. Most scholars suggest that the book of Judith was written probably during the time of the Maccabees, that terrible time when the very survival of the Jewish people was at stake, when the Syrian Greeks were, in the second century before the Common Era, demanded that Jews bow the knee to the pagan gods and give up their faith in the one God, when they proscribed the teaching of God's instruction, when Jewish life was besieged on all sides and there was a need to encourage the community to have faith that the dark days may be over, that weeping may tarry for the night, but with the morning there is joy. Judah satisfied that need and provided Israel with the great model of a heroine. You remember the book of Tobit, one of the nice little notes with which I close, with the idea that Tobias was accompanied on his journey by a dog, and that this was the first instance in literature of the dog being treated as a pet. I spoke a little bit about the concern of the Jewish tradition for the animals as well as for human beings. One of the nice little notes of Judith, and I close with this, is that when she returns from her triumph, her first act is to free the handmaid who has been with her. Slaves in ancient times were non-persons. They were animals, human animals, who served the free human beings. The biblical tradition from beginning to end tries to mitigate, if not avoid, the whole idea of slavery, but slavery was endemic to that early society. Free labor was impossible, really, before currency and before the market appeared in a more modern form. But in Judith, you get an act of manumission, that is, an act of the freeing of the slave as a central gift from the heroine to her slave, an act which was set up as a reminder of the Jew, to all Jews, that slavery was not a condition which the tradition applauded, and that whenever possible, the slave should be set free. You can find the book of Judith in the Apocrypha. You can find the Apocrypha in most Roman Catholic and some Protestant Bibles. You can find it in our library. And if you're intrigued, I would hope that you would go and enjoy the story of Judith and remind yourselves that women are indeed praised in our tradition, but that they are also seen in our tradition as capable of every act of which a man is capable, short of those which require the most brute and simple animal of physical strength. Amen.